The door at the head of the coach crashed back on its slide, and the white overseer stepped through and stood with his hands on his hips, grinning mirthlessly at them. And they lowered their heads and stared at the floor, hooding and screening their eyes. But those sitting close to Moses, the chosen ones, the elite, they began to understand then where the battle would be fought, and who were the kings that would be slain. The white overseer sensed the charged atmosphere in the coach. It was thick as the odour of unwashed black bodies and the stink of the latrine in the corner of the coach. It was as electric as the air at noon in the suicide days of November, just before the great rains break. And he searched quickly for Hendrik, sitting in the centre of the coach. "One rotten potato," he thought bitterly, "and the whole sackful is spoiled." He touched the billy club in his belt. He had found out the difficult way that the lash of the sjambok was too long to wield effectively in the confines of the coaches. The billy was a stopper, 14 inches of hard wood, the end drilled and filled with lead shot. He could break bone with it, crush in a skull to kill a man instantly if he needed to, or, with a delicate alteration of the weight of the blow, merely stun him. He was an artist with the billy club, as he was with the sjambok. But each had its place and time. It was the billy's time now. And he moved slowly down the coach, pretending to ignore Hendrik, examining the faces of each of the other men as he passed, seeing the new rebelliousness in their sullen faces, and becoming more angry with the man who had made his task more difficult. "I should have gone after him at the beginning," he told himself bitterly. "I've almost left it too late. Me, who loves the quiet life and the easy way. Well, we'll have to make the best of it now." He glanced casually at Hendrik as he passed, and then, from the corner of his eye, saw the big Ovambo relax slightly as he went on down the aisle between the seats. "You are expecting it, my boy," he thought. "You know it has to happen, and I'm not going to disappoint you." At the far end of the coach he paused, as if he had had an afterthought, and he came back down the aisle slowly, grinning to himself. Now he stopped in front of Hendrik again and sucked noisily at the cavity in his tooth. "Look at me, Kaffer," he invited pleasantly, and Hendrik lifted his chin and stared at him. "Which is your mpale?" he asked. "Which is your luggage?" And Hendrik was taken off guard. He was acutely conscious of the treasure of diamonds in the rack above his head, and now he glanced up at the leather sack instinctively. "Good." The white overseer lifted the sack off the rack and dropped it onto the floor in front of Hendrik. "Open it," he ordered, still grinning, one hand on his hip, the other on the handle of the billy. "Come on!" The grin became cold and wolfish as Hendrik sat without moving. "Open it, Kaffer! Let's see what you are hiding." It had never failed him yet. Even the most docile of men would react to protect their belongings, no matter how worthless and insignificantly. Slowly Hendrik leaned forward and untied the neck of the leather sack. Then he straightened again and sat passively. The white overseer stooped, seized the bottom of the sack, and straightened up again, never taking his eyes off Hendrik's face. He shook the sack vigorously, spilling the contents onto the floor. The blanket roll fell out first, and using the toe of his boot, the overseer spread it open. There was a sheepskin gilet and the other spare clothing in the roll, and a 9-inch knife in a leather sheath. "Dangerous weapon," said the overseer. "You know that no dangerous weapons are allowed in the coaches." He picked up the knife, pressed the blade into the niche of the window, and snapped it off. Then he tossed the two separate pieces out between the bars of the window behind Hendrik's head. Hendrik did not move, although the overseer waited for almost a minute, staring at him provocatively. The only sound was the clackety-clack of the bogey over the cross ties of the steel lines and the faint huffing of the locomotive at the head of the train. None of the other black passengers was watching the small drama develop. They were all staring straight ahead of them, faces closed, eyes unseeing. "What is this rubbish?" the overseer asked, and touched one of the hard, flat millet cakes with his toe. And though Hendrik did not move a muscle, the white man saw the first spark in those black, smoky eyes. "Yes," he thought gleefully, "that's it. Now he will move." And he picked up a loaf and sniffed it thoughtfully. "Kaffir bread," he murmured. "Not allowed. Company rules. No food allowed on the train." And he turned the flat loaf on edge so that it would pass between the bars, and he tossed it through the open window. The loaf bounced on the embankment below the racketing steel wheels and then shattered into fragments, and the overseer chuckled and stooped for the next loaf. It snapped in Hendrik's head. He had held it in check too long, and the loss of the diamonds drove him berserk. He went for the white man, launching himself out of the seat, but the overseer was ready for him. He straightened his right arm and drove the point of the billy club into Hendrik's throat. Then, as Hendrik fell back, choking and clutching at his throat, he whipped the club into the front of his skull, judging it finally not a killing blow, and Hendrik's hand dropped from his damaged throat as he toppled forward. However, the overseer would not let him fall, and with his left hand shoved him back against the seat, holding him upright while he worked with the club. It rang like an axe on wood as it bounced off the bone of Hendrik's skull, and it opened the thin skin of his scalp, and the blood sprang up in little ruby-bright fountains. The overseer hit him three times, measured, calculated blows, and then he thrust the point of the club into Hendrik's slack, gaping mouth, snapping off both his incisor teeth level with the gums. "Always mark them," it was one of his maxims. "Mark them so they don't forget." Only then did he release the unconscious man and let him topple, head first, into the center of the aisle. Instantly he whipped around and poised on his toes like a puff adder, cocking itself into the threatening S of the strike. With the billy club ready in his right hand, he stared down the shocked eyes of the black men around him. Quickly, they dropped their gaze from his, and the only movement was the jerking of their bodies in time to the swaying clatter of the coach beneath them. Hendrik's blood was puddling under his head, then running in little dark red snakes across the floor of the aisle. The overseer smiled again, looking down with an almost paternal expression at the recumbent figure. It had been a beautiful performance, quick and complete, exactly as he had planned it, and he had enjoyed it. The man at his feet was his own creation, and he was proud of it. He picked up the other millet loaves out of the blood puddle, and one at a time tossed them out between the bars of the window. Finally, he squatted over the man at his feet, and on the back of his shirt carefully wiped the last traces of blood from his billy. Then he stood up, replaced the club in his belt, and walked slowly down the aisle. It was all right now. The mood had changed. The atmosphere was defused. There would be no more trouble. He had done his job and done it well. He went out onto the balcony of the coach and, smiling thinly, locked the sliding door behind him again. The moment the door closed, the men in the carriage came back to life. Moses gave his orders crisply, and two of them lifted Hendrik back into his seat. Another went to the water tank beside the latrine door, while Moses opened his own pack and brought out a stoppered buckhorn. While they steadied Hendrik's lolling head, Moses poured a brown powder from the buckhorn into the wounds in his scalp. It was a mixture of ash and herbs, powdered finely, and he rubbed it into the open flesh with his finger. The bleeding stopped, and with a wet cloth he cleaned his brother's broken mouth. Then he cradled his unconscious head in his arms and waited. Moses had watched the conflict between his brother and the white man with almost clinical interest, deliberately restraining and directing Hendrik's reaction until the drama had reached this explosive climax. His attachment to his brother was still tenuous. Their father had been a prosperous and lusty man and had brought all of his 15 wives regularly to the child bed. Moses had over 30 brothers and sisters. Towards very few of them he felt any special affection beyond vague tribal and family duty. Hendrik was many years his senior and had left the kraal when Moses was still a child. Since then the tales of his exploits had filtered back to him, and Hendrik's reputation had grown on these accounts of wild and desperate deeds. But tales are only tales until they are proven, and reputations can be built on words and not deeds. The testing time was at hand. Moses would consider the results of the test, and upon them would depend their future relationship. He needed a hard man as his lieutenant, one of the steely men. Lenin had chosen Joseph Stalin. He would choose a man of steel also, a man like an axe. And with him as a weapon, he would hack and shape his own plans out of the hard wood of the future. If Hendrik failed the test, Moses would toss him aside with as little compassion as he would an axe whose blade had shattered at the first stroke against the trunk of a tree. Hendrik opened his eyes and looked at his brother with dilated pupils. He moaned and touched the open wounds on his scalp. He winced at the pain, and his pupils shrank and focused, and the rage flamed in their depths as he struggled upright. "The diamonds!" His voice was low and sibilant, as the hiss of one of those deadly little horned adders of the desert. "Gone," Moses told him quietly. "We must go back, find them." But Moses shook his head. "They are scattered like the seeds of the grass. There is no way to mark their fall. No, my brother, we are prisoners in this coach. We cannot go back. The diamonds are lost forever." Hendrik sat quietly, with his tongue exploring his shattered mouth, running it over the jagged stumps of his front teeth, considering his brother's cold logic. Moses waited quietly. This time he would give no orders, point no direction, no matter how subtle. Hendrik must come out of it by his own accord. "You are right, my brother," Hendrik said at last. "The diamonds are gone. But I am going to kill the man that did this to us." Moses showed no emotion. He offered no encouragement. He merely waited. "I will do it with cunning. I will find a way to kill him, and no man will ever know except him and us." Still Moses waited. So far, Hendrik was taking the path that he had laid out for him. However, there was still something else he must do. He waited for it, and it came as he had hoped it would. "Do you agree that I should kill this white dog, my brother?" He had asked for sanction from Moses Gama. He had acknowledged his liege lord, placed himself in his brother's hands. And Moses smiled and touched his brother's arm, as though he were placing a mark, a brand of approval upon him. "Do it, my brother," he ordered. If he failed, the white men would hang him on a rope. If he succeeded, he would have proved himself an axe, a steely man. Hendrik brooded darkly in his seat, not speaking for another hour. Occasionally massaging his temples, where the throbbing pain of the blows threatened to burst his skull open. Then he rose and moved slowly down the coach, examining each of the barred windows, shaking his head and muttering at the pain. He returned to his seat and sat there for a while, and then rose once again and shuffled down the aisle to the latrine cubicle. He locked himself into the cubicle. There was an open hole in the deck, and through it he could see the rushing blur of the stone embankment below the coach. Many of the men using the latrine had missed the hole, and the floor slopped with dark yellow urine and splattered feces. Hendrik turned his attention to the single unglazed window. The opening was covered with steel mesh in a wire frame, which was screwed into a wooden frame at each corner and at the centre of each side. He returned to his seat in the carriage and whispered to Moses, "The white baboon took my knife. I need another." Moses asked no questions. It was part of the test. Hendrik must do it alone, and if he failed, accept the full consequences, without expecting Moses to share them or attempt to aid him. He spoke quietly to the men around him, and within a few minutes a clasp knife was passed down the bench and slipped into Hendrik's hand. He returned to the latrine and worked on the retaining screws of the wire frame, careful not to scratch the paintwork around them or leave any sign that they had been tampered with. He removed all 8 screws, eased the frame from its seating, and set it aside. He waited until the tracks made a right-hand bend, judging by the centrifugal force against his body as the coach turned under him, and then he glanced out of the open window. The train was turning away from him, the leading coaches and the goods vans out of sight around the bend ahead, and he leaned out of the window and looked up. There was a combing along the edge of the roof of the coach. He reached up and ran his fingers over the ridge and found a handhold. He raised himself, putting his full weight upon it, hanging on his arms, only his feet still inside the latrine window, and the rest of his body suspended outside. He lifted his eyes to the level of the roof and memorized the slope and layout of the top of the coach. Then he lowered himself again and ducked back into the latrine. He replaced the mesh over the window, but turned the screws only finger tight, then went back to his seat in the coach. In the early evening, the white overseer and his 2 boss boys came through the coach with the food barrow. When he reached Hendrik, he smiled at him without rancor. "You are beautiful now, Kaffir. The black maids will love to kiss that mouth." He turned and addressed the silent ranks of black men. "If any of you want to be beautiful also, just let me know. I will do it for free." Just before dark, the boss boys came back to collect the empty dishes. "Tomorrow night you will be at Goldie," one of them told Hendrik. "There is a white doctor there who who will treat your wounds." There was a hint of sympathy in his impassive black face. "It was not wise of you to anger Tshela, the striker. You have learned a hard lesson, friend. Remember it well, all of you." He locked the door as he left the coach. Hendrik gazed out of the window at the sunset. In 4 days of travel, the landscape had changed entirely as they had climbed up onto the plateau of the High Veldt. The grasslands were pale brown, seared by the black frosts of winter, the red earth gouged open with dongers of erosion and divided into geometrical camps with barbed wire. The isolated homesteads seemed forlorn upon the open veldt, with the steel-framed windmills standing like gaunt sentinels over them. And the lean cattle were long-horned and party-coloured, red and black and white. Hendrik, who had lived his life in the unpeopled wilderness, found the fences cramping and restrictive. In this place, you could never be out of sight of other men or their works. And the villages they passed were as sprawling and populous as Windhoek, the biggest town he had ever conceived of. "Wait until you see Goldie," Moses told him, as the darkness fell outside, and the men around them settled down for the night, wrapping their blankets over their heads, for the chill of the High Veldt blew in through the open windows. Hendrik waited until the white overseer made his first round of the coaches, and when he shone the beam of his lantern into Hendrik's face, made no attempt to feign sleep, but blinked up at him blindly. The overseer passed on, locking the door as he left the coach. Hendrik rose quietly in the seat. Opposite him, Moses stirred in the darkness but did not speak, and Hendrik went down the aisle and locked himself in the latrine. Quickly he loosened the screws and worked the frame off its seating. He set it against the bulkhead and leaned out of the window. The cold night air buffeted his head, and he slitted his eyes against the hot smuts that blew back from the coal-burning locomotive and stung his cheeks and forehead as he reached up and found his handholds on the ridge of the combing. He drew himself upwards smoothly, and then, with a kick and a heave, flung the top half of his body over the edge of the roof and shot out one arm. He found a grip on the ventilator in the middle of the curved roof and pulled himself the rest of the way on his belly. He lay for a while panting and with his eyes tightly closed until he got control of the pounding ache in his head. Then he raised himself to his knees and began crawling forward towards the leading edge of the roof. The night sky was clear. The land was silver with starlight and blue with shadow, and the wind roared about his head. He rose to his feet and balanced against the lurch and sway of the coach. With his feet wide apart and his knees bent, he moved forward. A premonition of danger made him look up, and he saw the dark shape rush at him out of the darkness, and he threw himself flat just as the steel arm of one of the railway water towers flashed over his head. A second later, it would have decapitated him, and he shivered with the cold and the shock of near death. After a minute, he gathered himself and crawled forward again, not raising his head more than a few inches until he reached the front edge of the roof. He lay spread-eagled on his belly and cautiously peered over the edge. The balconies of the joining coaches were below him, the gap between the roof about the span of one of his arms. Directly under him, the footplates articulated against each other as the train clattered through the curves of the line. Anybody moving from one coach to the next must pass below where Hendrik lay, and he grunted with satisfaction and looked behind him. One of the ventilator pots was just level with his feet as he lay outstretched. He crawled back, drawing the heavy leather belt from the top of his breeches, and buckled it around the ventilator, forming a loop, into which he thrust one of his feet as far as the ankle. Once again he stretched out onto the roof, one foot securely anchored by the loop, and he reached down into the space between the coaches. He could just touch the banisters of the guard fence around the balcony. Electric bulbs in wire cages were fixed to the overhang of the balconies, so the area below him was well lit. He drew back and lay flat on the roof, only the top of his head and his eyes showing from below. But he knew that the lights would dazzle anybody who looked upwards into the gap between the roofs, and he settled down to wait, like a leopard in the tree over the waterhole. An hour passed, and then another. But he judged the passage of time only by the slow rotation of the stars across the night sky. He was stiff and freezing cold as the wind thrashed his unprotected body. But he bore it stoically, never allowing himself to doze or lose concentration. Waiting was always a major part of the hunt, of the game of death, and he had played this game 100 times before. Suddenly, even over the rush of the train's passage and the rhythm of the cross ties, he heard the click of steel on steel and the rattle of keys in the lock of the door below him, and he gathered himself. The man would step over the footplates as quickly as he could, not wanting to be in that vulnerable and exposed position for a moment longer than was necessary to make the crossing, and Hendrik would have to be quicker still. He heard the sliding door slam back against the jamb, and the lock turn again. Then, an instant later, the crown of the white overseer's hat appeared below him. Instantly, Hendrik shot his body forward and dropped as far as his waist into the gap between the coaches. Only the leather belt around his ankle anchored him. Lothar had taught him the double lock, and he whipped one arm around the white man's neck and braced his other hand in the crook of his own elbow, catching the man's head in the vice of his arms, and jerked him off his feet. The white man made a strangled, cawing sound, and droplets of spittle flew from his lips, sparkling in the electric light, as Hendrik drew him upwards as though he were hoisted on the gallows tree. The white man's hat fell from his head and flitted away into the night like a black bat, and he was kicking and twisting his body violently, clawing at the thick muscled arms that were locked around his neck, his long blonde hair fluttering and tumbling in the night wind. Hendrik lifted him until their eyes were inches apart, and he smiled into his face, exposing the mangled black pit of his own mouth, his shattered front teeth still stained with clotted blood. And in the reflection of the balcony lights, the white man recognized him. Hendrik saw the recognition flare in his pale, dilated eyes. "Yes, my friend," he whispered. "It is me, the Kaffer." He drew the man up another inch and wedged the back of his neck against the edge of the roof. Then, very deliberately, he put pressure on his spine at the base of his skull. The white man writhed and struggled like a fish on the barbs of the harpoon, but Hendrik held him easily, staring deep into his eyes, and bent his neck backwards, lifting with his forearm under the chin. Hendrik felt the spine loading and locking at the pressure. It could give no more, and for a second longer he held him at the breaking point. Then, with a jerk, he pushed the man's chin up another inch, and the spine snapped like a dry branch. The white man danced in the air, twitching and shuddering, and Hendrik watched the pale blue eyes glaze over, becoming opaque and lifeless. And over the rush of the wind, he heard the soft, spluttering release as his sphincter muscle relaxed and his bowels involuntarily voided. Hendrik swung his dangling corpse like a pendulum, and as it cleared the balcony rail, he let it drop into the gap between the coaches, directly into the track of the racing wheels. It was sucked away by the spinning steel, like a scrap of meat into the blades of a mincing machine. He lay for a moment, recovering his breath. He knew that the overseer's mutilated corpse would be smeared over half a mile of the railway tracks. He untied his belt from the ventilator and buckled it around his waist. Then he crawled back along the roof of the coach until he was directly above the latrine window. He lowered his feet over the sill and, with a twist, dropped into the cubicle. He replaced the mesh frame over the window and tightened the screws. He went back down the coach to his seat, and Moses Garmer was watching him as he wrapped the blanket around his shoulders. He nodded at his brother and pulled the corner of the blanket over his head. Within minutes, he was asleep.